Our scripture will be Genesis 2, 21 through 25. And the Lord God caused a deep sleep to fall upon Adam, and he slept, and he took one of his ribs and closed up the flesh in its place. Then the rib which the Lord God had taken from man, he had made into woman, and he brought her to the man. And Adam said, "This is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman, because she was taken out of man. Therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. And they were both naked, the man and his wife, and were not ashamed."
It's sort of a, if you've heard it before, you know, it's sort of like a movie term, or you think about when someone's telling a story, especially in movie format, and you're watching it, and breaking the fourth wall would be someone in the movie who sort of comes out of the story and comes out of the narrative and actually is talking directly to the audience. One movie that made that concept or that idea, that practice sort of famous was, I believe it was an 80s movie, Ferris Bueller's Day Off. And at the end of that movie, there's like a post-credit scene. And that post-credit scene is the young boy who's been in the movie the whole time, and it's a story about him skipping school and things like that. If he gets to the end of the movie, steps out of the shower, has his towel around him, and he looks at the camera and he says, "What are you doing here? Why are you still here? The movie's over. Go home." And sort of a comedic moment, but it caught people's attention and caught people off guard because you had the character in the movie actually talking directly to you. So there's that idea of breaking the fourth wall. In the passage we just read in Genesis 2, you see that a little bit. Well, the writer of Genesis, in Genesis, is this whole story, starting with the creation of man. It's this whole story. It's a narrative. And for the most part, the book doesn't break the story. It doesn't come out and make application of principles, or it doesn't talk directly to the audience, except in this one moment, in this one passage here, that you could say the fourth wall is broken. In Genesis 2:18, God said, "It's not good that the man should be alone. I will make him a helper worthy, a suitable for him, a helpmeet for him." And then beginning in 21, he puts Adam in that deep sleep, takes out his rib, from that rib makes woman. And then the writer there gives the application of that. "Therefore shall a man leave his father and mother, cleave to his wife, and the two become one." Such an important principle, so much that the text comes out of the story and tells that to you as the audience. Here's what you need to know. Here's how you are supposed to apply this example in the narrative right now, this point in the story. So you see how important that is, that the husband and wife becoming one flesh together. Now, certainly, I think that would be a reference to the physical intimate relationship, but when Jesus references this passage in Matthew 19, and he's talking about marriage and divorce and remarriage, he references this in a way where seems like he's talking about the marriage relationship as a whole. Or he says, "What God has joined together, let no man put asunder," talking about divorce. Don't separate the husband and wife. Don't divide them. Don't put them asunder. That coming together of husband and wife, I believe, encapsulates the whole of the relationship, that bond of them coming together. You could say the husband and wife fusing together. That's going to be a key word that you're going to hear me use today. You're going to hear me say today in this morning's lesson, as well as the lesson tonight, of two people coming together, fusing together in their relationship and in their bond. That connectedness, that fondness they have for one another. And it's great, and it's a blessing, and it's wonderful of a husband and wife becoming one together and fusing together. But if there's no limits in that relationship, if there's no boundaries, you could say you could become too bonded. You could become too fused together. Well, how would that be? What would that look like? Well, the perfect example would be just in the next chapter over. In Genesis 3, the serpent tempts Eve with the fruit. And Eve brings the fruit to Adam and says, "Eat this with me." And Adam has a moment there where he has to make a choice. Certainly he has to decide whether, you know, I want to eat this fruit or whether I want to obtain this knowledge or not. But he's also having to make a choice about his relationship. To say whether or not I'm going to go along with my wife in this action, or if I'm going to set a boundary and say, no, I can't do this with you. No, God has commanded otherwise. No, my relationship with God supersedes my relationship with you. Pleasing God supersedes pleasing you, Eve. And that's more important. He could have set that boundary there. He could have stopped it right then and there, but he didn't. And he ate the fruit and chose not only the knowledge of good and evil, but also that oneness, that relationship with Eve, more than valuing that relationship with God. I bring all that up as an example to say there are times, there are ways and there are circumstances where we can have relationships in our life, not just marriage. We can have relationships in our lives where we are too bonded, we're too fused with another person or people. So much so that we don't have appropriate boundaries set up. We are too dependent on them. That relationship is too intertwined. And it has a lot to say about our relationship with God. Perhaps that he's not as much of a priority as that person or that group of people in our lives. I'm going to talk about this idea then of asking the question, am I too fused? Am I too fused together with anybody in my life? This morning's lesson is going to focus in the context of the family system. In tonight's lesson, we're going to go a little more broadly, talking about more community. But this lesson today is going to focus on this question, am I too fused with my children? Am I too fused with my children? As I thought about this point and working on this lesson, there was one story in the Bible that came to my mind every single time as I thought about this point. That was the story of Isaac, Rebecca, Jacob, and Esau. Turn over to Genesis 25. Genesis 25, start at verse 24. Talking about Isaac and Rebekah here. When her days to give birth were completed, behold, there were twins in her womb. The first came out red and all his body like a hairy cloak, so they called his name Esau. Afterwards, his brother came out with his hand holding Esau's heel, so his name was called Jacob. Isaac was 60 years old when she bore them. Verse 27, when the boys grew up, Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field, while Jacob was a quiet man, dwelling in tents. Isaac loved Esau because he ate of his game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. You see the seeds are planted there kind of in that initial setting for the story with Jacob and Esau. You see kind of why they're going to be at odds with one another. But also, as much as we focus on Jacob and Esau kind of being in tension, also notice Isaac and Rebekah's role in this. Isaac loved Esau. Rebekah loved Jacob. One parent is bonding, one parent is bonding with the other child. They've, in a sense, kind of got their favorites lined up there. I even think it's interesting because you see there that I believe it's verse 27, or verse 28 rather. Isaac loved Esau because he ate of his game. He ate the food that Esau would go out and he would hunt these animals and then prepare the meals for him and give it to his father. Interesting later, as Jacob and Esau are kind of quarreling with one another, Esau sells his birthright for a bowl of food. You almost see that connection that like father, like son, they both kind of have the same desires, kind of have the same passions for one another. Maybe it's the fact that they're sort of similar as to why Isaac has such fondness for Esau. But as you go on through the story, turn over to chapter 27 now. Genesis chapter 27. Starting at the beginning. So we see this family dynamic, this conflict kind of develop. Genesis 27 and verse 1. When Isaac was old and his eyes were dim so that he could not see, he called Esau, his older son. And he said to him, "My son." And he answered, "Here I am." He said, "Behold, I'm old. I don't know the day of my death. Now then, take your weapons, your quiver, and your bow, and go out to the field and hunt game for me, and prepare for me delicious food, such as I love. And bring it to me so that I may eat, that my soul may bless you before I die." Setting the stage here, Esau, I want you to go out, get this food, and I'm going to give you a blessing when you bring it back and prepare it for me. As you go through the text a little bit further, Rebecca's listening in on this, and she wants some favor for her favorite son. She wants a blessing for Jacob. So she conspires with Jacob, and she comes up with this elaborate idea. Let's trick your father. Let's dress you up like your Esau. Let's get some food. Let's get some meat to prepare for your father. And go in there and pretend like your Esau, so that he can give you the blessing instead of giving it to Esau. Going down to verse 18. Genesis 27, verse 18. So he went to his father and he said, "My father." And he said, "Here I am. Who are you, my son?" Jacob said to his father, "I'm Esau, your firstborn. I've done as you told me. Now sit up and eat of my game, and your soul may bless me." But Isaac said to his son, "How's that you found it so quickly, my son?" He answered, "Because the Lord your God granted me success." Then Isaac said to Jacob, "Please come near, that I may feel you, my son, to know whether you are really my son Esau or not." So Jacob went near to Isaac, his father, who felt him and said, "The voice is Jacob's voice, but the hands are the hands of Esau." He didn't recognize him because his hands were hairy like his brother Esau's hands. So he blessed him. He said, "Are you really my son Esau?" He answered, "I am." Then he said, "Bring it near to me, that I may eat of my son's game and bless you." So he brought it near to him, and he ate, and he brought him the wine, and he drank. Isaac senses there's something a little bit off. There's something a little bit wrong. How did you go get the food that quickly? How did you hunt the animal and prepare the meat that fast? We just had this conversation. That's a little bit unusual. And your voice sounds a little bit different too. But the dress up was just convincing enough that Isaac could say, "Well, maybe my mind's playing tricks on me. My hearing's not that well. My vision's not that well. Maybe I'm just thinking a little too much about it." And so he eventually goes along with it. Jacob gets the blessing instead of Esau. You see this whole family dynamic then. And so that's the story in a nutshell. But so we come back to that actual question then. When you look at this family situation, what are some examples? What would it look like practically to say, if I am a parent who is too fused with my child, who is too bonded with my child to the point that I don't have enough proper boundaries set up? Let me give you just a few examples here. Number one, I might be too fused with my child when I show favoritism to one child over the other. I might be too fused, too bonded with my child when I start having a favorite. And that's exactly what you see here with Rebecca and Isaac. The children were born, and right then and there, they've got their favorites. And even more so is as their personality sort of develops. Again, Jacob, or Isaac rather, has that passion for the food and that's hunted and that's prepared. And Esau is the one that goes and hunts and prepares it. Esau also sold his birthright for the food. They've got some similar passions. They're very alike with one another. Jacob was the one who, it says, he was quiet. He dwelled in tents. You got that one child who, you could say, he goes out and he's a rugged young man, and he's strong and he hunts. And you got the other child who just maybe stays in and keeps his nose in the books. You got these two very different children, and maybe Rebecca looks at that and says, "You know what, Jacob's a little bit more like me," and she has her favorite too. But the problem is, when you start playing favorites with the kids, there's some inappropriate relationships that are developing. There's too much bonding, there's too much fusing that's going on there. And maybe this is something that I don't know that I've ever heard the topic really discussed or talked about. Talking about parents playing favorites with children. I know when I was young, I always told my mom, "You've got your favorites," and I know it's not me. I always said it was my older brother. He's the favorite baby. You love him more. And maybe you've done that too, parents. I'm sure probably most parents here have heard that yourselves, right? And you don't believe that. You say, no, I love you. I love each and every one of you. And hopefully that's true. But I would also say, let's not assume that's something that can never happen to families in the church. Let's not assume that's something, because we're Christians, we're immune to that. As Christian parents, that can never happen. I was one of four children, and I'm going to tell you right now, each one of us is completely different from the other. If you met my brother, you would say he looks so much like me. Personality-wise, he's very different. Same thing goes with my older sister, with my younger sister. And because of that, some of us are more like my father than others. Some of us are more like my mother than others. And it's okay that, you know, if a parent has sort of different, unique relationships with each child, that's not a bad thing. That's not a wrong thing. But the problem comes when it turns to, I love this child more because this child's more like me. I love this child more because the child has more in common with me. Just because we're Christians, let's not assume that we're immune to that. I might be too bonded, I might be too fused with my children when I show favoritism to one child over the other. Number two, I might be too fused with my children when I communicate with my child, but not with my spouse. I might be too fused with my children if I communicate with my child, but not my spouse. Or maybe we could even word it as, if I communicate significantly more with my child than with my spouse. In this whole story, you don't, as soon as Jacob and Esau are born and you see the tension between them and Rebekah and Isaac picking their favorites, you don't see Rebekah and Isaac really talking about the situation. It's not revealed to us. Okay, we're not given any information about how they feel about the situation, if they've discussed this idea of them having their favorites or them communicating together. And maybe it's the case that they did, and they talked about it a lot, and the Bible just didn't give us that information. But I find it interesting that in the whole story, there's no communication about it. But really, there's a lot of communication between Isaac and Esau. There's a lot of communication between Rebekah and Jacob, but not in the marriage. In our relationships today, whenever there's some tension, whenever we have marital conflicts with one another, if communication ever shuts down between a husband and a wife, who do we turn to? Who's the next person that we go to? If we can't communicate the person we are supposed to be one with, we're supposed to be one flesh with, who else do we go to? Sometimes the parents go to the children and talk to the children about their struggles and their challenges and their difficulties and vent all of that emotion, and they vent that stress, but they don't do it with the spouse anymore. And to play both sides of that, maybe that's because the other spouse has become emotionally unavailable and refuses to communicate, and one spouse is trying really hard, but the other won't make them that available. But you put your husband, you put your wife in a position now where they're going to become overly bonded with the child, to the point you're putting that child in the position to handle all your parents' stress and anxiety and these adult problems that they're not ready to face or they're not equipped to handle. And how do they deal with that? That puts a lot of burden on the child. I don't know how much, as parents, I don't know how much you share with your children about maybe your marital conflicts or arguments you have. Maybe you don't share at all. Maybe you share a little bit. Maybe you tell them a little bit about what's going on, especially if they see a fight. Maybe you want to talk to them about what they saw and what they heard. But when the distance happens between husband and wife, when there's no communication there, and there's a lot of communication between mom and son or dad and son or dad and daughter, you can be a little bit overly fused with your child. At least one more example then. I might be too fused with my child if I show favoritism, if I communicate with my child but not my spouse. Number three, I might be too fused with my child when I team up with my child against my spouse. If I create this team mentality where it's me and my child against the person I am married to, you might hear that and you think, well, that's ridiculous. That would never happen. Well, have you ever known family going through divorce? Did you ever grow up? Did you grow up personally as a family, as a child of a family who went through divorce? If you did, and I'm not saying every divorce happens this way or that this is always or mostly happens, but it does happen, where a husband and wife or former husband and wife are so at odds with one another when they have the kids by themselves, they start talking about the other parent. It's not just that you're communicating your frustrations and your challenges and your difficulties, but now you're trying to turn that child against the other parent, against the other spouse, trying to tell them how the breakdown in the relationship was their fault and that you should be on my side and you should be against them. Rebecca, in some degree, does this when she teams up with Jacob to trick their father. And I don't paint her as the main problem or the main antagonist of this story. That's not what I'm saying. But she does become proactive in trying to get Jacob to trick their father. She does. She absolutely does. And it's really her idea. It wasn't even Jacob that started the initial thoughts of, well, I can put hair over here and he won't be able to see me. No, it was Rebecca being proactive. And again, let's not assume that even as Christians, even as Christian parents and as Christian families, that we are immune to those type of problems and those type of difficulties and breakdowns in our relationship. Because it's not just a family going through the divorce. It can be even before that point. If a husband and wife are at odds with one another, guess what? If you have a strong point on your side and you believe you're right, and your spouse has a strong point and you believe they're right, and they believe they're right, and you want somebody to help validate your feelings or validate your viewpoint, well, there's your child right there. It can be a very easy temptation. It can be very easy to get drawn into that. And we put the child in a position where I have to choose whether I love parent or love one parent or I love the other, if I love one or if I hate the other. It's not fair. I might be too fused with my children if I show favoritism or if I communicate with my child more than my spouse or if I team up with my child against my spouse. I remember when I was doing my internship here, I remember drawing on a whiteboard in a class. I was talking about a class about leadership, and at some point, being an elder came up and the qualifications of an elder, or the qualities of an elder. And one of the qualifications was the elder being a good leader in his home and having faithful Christian children. And somehow the conversation went around to what should we do to help raise good, faithful kids. And I that wasn't initially the direction I was going. That's kind of just the way the class went. And here I am, this young man, been married a few years, don't have any kids, talking to a room full of people who have been married much longer than I have, that have children, that have gone through, are in the process of, or have already gone through raising kids. And you can imagine how that kind of went, just kind of the image of that. But I remember Cletus raising his hand, and he said, John, I'm going to invoke my inner Cletus here. He said, John, he said, young man, you know more about raising children now than you ever will after you have kids. And that scared me. Because I didn't say it out loud. I thought to myself, though, I don't know that much about raising kids right now. So the bar's going to go down a whole lot lower. I'm not an expert on child rearing or child raising. I don't want to give that impression by any means. But I feel like I can say this and it'd be easily agreed with. You could even say maybe it'd be common sense, and especially I believe I could say it's biblical. No matter what approach you take to raising your children or what particular needs your child have in trying to train them up, I think it would be fair to say that every child would be better off if mom and dad had a healthy relationship. Every child would be better off if mom and dad communicated effectively. Every child would be better off if mom and dad loved their children, all of their children, unequivocally. When you go to these different passages like Ephesians 5, where Paul, or Ephesians 6, 1, where Paul says, fathers, raise your children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. Before that, he says, husbands, love your wives, as Christ loved the church. Wives, be submissive to your husbands. You go to Colossians 1, and at the end of the chapter, it says, fathers, don't provoke your children to wrath. Before that, it says, husbands, love your wives, don't be harsh to them. It says, wives, be submissive to your husbands as unto the Lord. God never saw the rearing of children and the developing of a healthy marriage and relationship as two separate things. They're not distinct. They're not mutually exclusive. They are directly tied together. What I believe we see here with Isaac and Rebekah and Jacob and Esau is a family where maybe in the marriage there's been some distance created and some overbonding with the children, some overfusing with the children. And it doesn't end well for the kids either. Jacob ends up running away. And then, ironically, Jacob has a host of his own children as well. And guess what happens? He follows in the parents' footsteps, and he has his favorite, Joseph. And then you have a process all over again of the favoritism causing controversy among the children and all the children conspiring against the other child. It disrupts the entire family dynamic. Every child needs a mom and dad with a healthy relationship. And all that said, I would close this lesson with a passage in Matthew 10, verses 34 and 35, around those verses, where Jesus says, he who loves father or mother more than me, they're not worthy of me. He who loves son or daughter more than me are not worthy of me. And that's not Jesus saying you need to love your parents less, or you need to love your children less, or you need to love your spouse less. It's saying you need to love me more. That in all those different relationships you have, that all the ones you are bonded with, you are fused with, you are connected with these people, there needs to be a boundary set up where it says, you are important to me, I love you, but God is more important, and I love him more. That's what Adam should have said when Eve brought him the fruit. That's what Isaac and Rebekah should have said when they stopped communicating and they started bonding with their children and started conspiring to trick one to deceive the other. They should have said, you know what, God has told me as a husband I need to love you. And as a wife I need to love you. God needs to come first before all of my relationships. And I need to make sure I'm not too fused and I'm not too overly bonded. So that starts with then making sure if I'm going to put God's relationship first in my life, it needs to start with me having an actual relationship with him. Being buried with him in baptism, putting on Christ, being washed, having my sins washed away. Friends, that's where the relationship starts. But even for us who have done that and who have been Christians for a long time, maybe we need to ask ourselves, in all of my relationships, is God elevated higher? Is that boundary set up in all of them? Or do I happen to be too fused? That said, I want to give you that encouragement this morning as we offer the invitation. You can stand and sing at this time.
What will you do with Jesus? The answer comes to you, and you must give.